Hello and welcome to Essential Dissent, coming to you from the last days of the U.S. Empire. I'm Wilton Vaught, producer of the series. This episode is a talk by Gabriel Rockhill called Liberalism and Fascism. Gabriel Rockhill is an American philosopher, writer, and cultural critic, and is professor of philosophy at Villanova University. The event was sponsored by the Young Democratic Socialists of America and took place on April 18, 2025 at Kansas State University. Please note that the views expressed on Essential Dissent are those of the individual speakers and do not necessarily represent my own views or those of this radio station.
The topic for today is something that I've been working on for quite some time because I think it's integral for all of us to understand what fascism is, where it comes from, and most importantly, how to fight it, and what the fight looks like when you don't just win it in the short term, but when you win it in the long term. And part of what I'm going to present is the opening section to a book that I've been working on called, and don't be scared of the title, Fascism and the Socialist Solution. The opening comments are going to be somewhat of a conceptual nature. There was someone here earlier who was joking about me citing Hegel or maybe getting all philosophical. There is a philosophic component, but the reason I want to start with this is because of how strange the concept of fascism is and how it tends to operate to obfuscate the actual material reality of fascism. So the concept of fascism, as it is commonly used within mainstream discourse, functions in the most singular fashion. When the question is raised if such or such phenomenon is fascist, it is considered perfectly natural to compare it to the supposed touchstone of fascism, which is taken to be the form that it took in Italy and especially Germany. Paul Sweezy described the situation as follows, quote, "For a political system to qualify as fascist, it has to display the German or Italian characteristics of fascism. It must be based on a fascist mass movement anchored primarily in paramilitary formations of brown shirts or black shirts. It must be a one-party regime with a party headed by a Führer or some other figure symbolizing the principle of authoritarian leadership. It must be violently nationalist, racist, anti-Semitic. It must be frankly illiberal, intolerant of opposition, hostile to civil liberties and human rights." This is quite obviously the standard yardstick. So we ask questions like, well, are there swastikas, goose steps, and Nazi salutes? There are Nazi salutes, by the way, but this ends up being the qualifying attribute of whether or not something counts as fascism. There are more or less extreme versions of this approach. Some of them focus specifically on Nazism as the ideal type of fascism, whereas others concentrate slightly more generally on a classical model of fascism found in Italy as well as Germany. The essential conceptual move, though, is identical. It is the particular historical manifestation of fascism that is supposed to define the general and not the other way around. A specific manifestation of fascism is assumed to serve as the touchstone for judging whether or not fascism exists in a particular instance. Now, we should take a moment to register how strange this is, because other political concepts don't function in this manner. Becomes readily apparent if one thinks, for instance, of a category like revolution. Would it be appropriate to draw the conclusion that an uprising is a revolution if and only if the same fundamental pattern it follows is that of the French Revolution, for instance? Should one specific revolution serve as the touchstone for all revolutions? The absurdity of such a proposition becomes obvious if you consider a widely used political concept like that of a state. Should we restrict our use of the term only to those situations that resemble a particular state, such as the United States? What about the category of dictatorship? Can the concept of colonialism refer only to the model of French colonialism in Africa? Now, a likely criticism of this line of argumentation, or what's implicit in what I just said, is that the concept of fascism emerged in Italy to describe a novel form of politics, and it therefore makes sense to consider it as the prototypical exemplar of fascism. It is certainly true that this is where the concept emerged, but it's highly significant, as Benito Mussolini himself regularly insisted, that it first appeared as an inchoate, disorganized movement that was only later and awkwardly conceptualized. Fascism in Italy was an evolving project that changed very significantly over time. The practice was primary, and its conceptualization followed in turn, meaning that there was not a predefined idea of fascism that determined the practice, but rather a shifting series of activities that were later conceptualized as fascism. When the term emerged, it was strongly affiliated with Italy, to such an extent, in fact, that the Nazis themselves often referred to the fascists as people distinct from themselves, meaning the people in Italy. By contrast, the Nazis called themselves National Socialists, abusing the term socialist, by the way, which we could come back to in the Q&A. In 1934, Joseph Goebbels wrote in Fascism and Its Practical Results, quote, "Mussolini stands at the beginning and at the end of the political development that we call fascism. Fascism is a phenomenon that entered the world of phenomena for the first time with Mussolini. Fascism received from Mussolini not only the idea, but also the shape and organization." End quote. Fascism in this sense was understood as a proper name. It stood for the unique form of politics implemented in Italy under Mussolini. In Mein Kampf, Hitler also used the term fascism in this manner to refer to political developments in Italy. But at the same time, Italian fascism clearly exercised an important influence over German National Socialism. And Goebbels recognized this. He described this in terms of a confluence between them insofar as they're both driving in the same direction. Quote, "I'm firmly convinced that the political direction that we today call fascism in Italy, and which we call in Germany National Socialism, will gradually penetrate the whole of Europe, that there can no longer be any inhibition or obstacle to it, and that the future of our continent depends on the breakthrough of this political phenomenon," end quote. He is here identifying a common practice behind two different national movements affiliated with the concepts of Nazism and fascism at the time. It is this common practice that would be conceptually identified with the term fascism. Rather than simply functioning as a proper name, tethered to the specific type of rule in Italy under Mussolini, the term was given its conceptual birthright by being elevated to the status of a genus with multiple species, right? National Socialism and Italian fascism being species of the genus fascism. In this regard, it is important to note that at the same time, there was a clear identification of movements around, or I should say, across the capitalist world that were recognized as fascist in this sense, including, very importantly, if you look at the mainstream press in the United States in the 1930s, the Ku Klux Klan, which was identified as being an American version of fascism. So even though the term fascism was minted in Italy and it originally functioned as a proper name to refer to this unique phenomenon, it became a concept by being recognized as a more general category that could be applied to other instances. In the 1930s, the communist movement widely used the concept of fascism to refer not only to Italy and Germany, but also to similar reactionary political movements across the entire capitalist world. There were fascist movements in every capitalist country in the wake of the Great Depression. Figures like Antonio Gramsci, Togliatti, Dutt, and many others used the concept in this sense. Nazism, by contrast, largely remained a proper name, used to index the specific form of fascism in Germany and those who identified directly with it, including, of course, after the war. In other words, fascism was broadly recognized as the genus of which Nazism and Italian fascism were but species. With all of this in mind, we can now return to the common sense understanding of fascism in the contemporary world. What is remarkable is that at least when the term is invoked to discuss developments in the capitalist world, the category of fascism is often deprived of its conceptual power of generalization because it is collapsed into a particular instantiation thereof. Such particularization renders the concept ineffective, since, at least in extreme cases, it simply becomes a matter of studying how a specific phenomenon measures up to a particular ideal type of fascism. Rather than Nazism and Italian fascism being recognized as specific manifestations of a more general phenomenon, fascism, they become the universal form by which all potential forms of fascism are judged. The relationship between the particular and the universal is thereby inverted. Rather than the particular being subsumed under the universal, it is the general that is subservient to the specific. So the very idea of fascism is they're deprived of one of the major features of concepts in general, their ability to concretely abstract from empirical particulars to identify patterns at a higher level of generality. Without this power of concrete abstraction, a concept is reduced to little more than an empirical description of one particular phenomenon. It's quite literally deconceptualized. It has no power as a concept. It instead comes to function more like a proper name that indexes a singular reality. Instead of fascism functioning like other political concepts, by identifying general patterns, it comes to function more like a proper name organically linked to one particular social phenomenon. To simplify this, it would be, well, somebody's a Nazi because they give a Nazi salute, or somebody's a fascist because they have a swastika tattooed on them, but you couldn't recognize someone as a fascist if they do not have those particular attributes. The conceptual reduction of fascism to the proper name of a particular is also visible in one of the other tendencies within the mainstream conceptualization of fascism. If it is invoked to refer to developments in the capitalist world above and beyond the Nazi fascist exemplar, it is most often used as a form of moral or political condemnation of an individual, such as Trump, Orban, Musk, Bolsonaro, rather than as a critique of the system that produces such individuals. A single person is thereby judged to be fascist, usually based on the Hitler-Mussolini model, but this again singularizes the concept of fascism, depriving it of its power of generalization and its ability to describe a system of governance within which individuals operate. The overall ideological effect of the particularization of the concept of fascism, which destroys its power of generalization by reducing it to a proper name, is to impose the idea that fascism is a singular aberration within the capitalist world. If this unique phenomenon reappears, it primarily rears its evil head in individuals, not the system that produced them, once again promoting the assumption that fascism is an exceptional development. The next section of my talk is totalitarianism, or the ubiquitous affiliation between fascism and communism. So the ideology of fascist exceptionalism, that's what I've been describing. The ideology of fascist exceptionalism primarily applies to the capitalist world, and more specifically to the imperialist countries and their allies, the leading capitalist powers, Western Europe and the United States. It implicitly suggests that the abhorrent violence of fascism only manifests itself in the imperialist world order in the rarest of instances, and perhaps only once in history, or only through the nefarious effects of diabolical individuals. Capitalist societies involved in imperialism are thereby depicted as structurally devoid of fascism, at least for the most part, and the latter is presented as a rare disease that has only infected a few aberrant societies or individuals. The ideology of fascist exceptionalism thereby goes hand in hand with the assumption that fascism is an irregularity within the capitalist world and a radical departure from its normal function. By contrast, there has been a powerful ideological effort to use the concept of fascism in the opposite sense when it comes to socialist countries, generalizing it to the utmost as a characteristic of most, if not all, societies that have sought to liberate themselves from capitalism. The master concept that has played a major role in these ideological endeavors is that of totalitarianism. This concept was originally used by communists to describe the totalitarian control of workers' lives under capitalism. However, in the post-war era, figures like Zbigniew Brzezinski and Hannah Arendt attempted to redefine totalitarianism as a general conceptual category that applied equally to fascism and communism. This was part of a larger psychological warfare campaign on the part of imperialist states to redefine fascism in such a way that it was seen to be a feature of communist societies. Brzezinski and Arendt had ties to the US national security state and the national security state of the United Kingdom, and they were involved to some degree in academically laundering state-driven propaganda. Here we arrive then at the central paradox of the common sense use of the concept of fascism. Whereas it is treated as a singular aberration within the capitalist world, it is judged to be ubiquitous in, or even a constitutive feature of, the communist or socialist world. It is singularized to such an extent that it all but disappears under capitalism, whereas it is generalized to such an extent under communism that some major Western analysts, like Theodore Adorno and Max Horkheimer of the Frankfurt School, have claimed that fascism and communism are simply the same thing. Slavoj Žižek has recently continued this trend by drawing on the dubious scholarship of the eugenicist A. James Greger to assert that post-Deng China is a variant of contemporary fascism. This process of conceptual overgeneralization not only applies to communist countries, but it also includes nearly any strong state that resists imperialism. To take but a few examples, political figures like Saddam Hussein, Omar Gaddafi, and Bashar al-Assad have regularly been compared to Hitler, thereby suggesting that they were the leaders of modern-day Nazi states. I've never encountered a mainstream discourse that applies the ideology of fascist exceptionalism to countries like Iraq, Libya, and Syria, meaning a discourse that cried foul and claimed that the comparison is absolutely illegitimate because the fundamental features of the Third Reich were not present. There weren't swastikas, Nazi salutes, etc. The same is very much true of the condemnation of communism as fascism. Have the ideologues of empire ever held their analysis of communist countries up to the same standard as capitalist countries when it's a matter of comparing them to the touchstone of Nazism and fascism? And have any of them claimed, for instance, that Poland and Czechoslovakia did not share essential characteristics, or that more generally, their anti-colonial, anti-capitalist internationalism inexorably separated them from the colonial capitalist ultranationalism of fascism? We see here, and this is my basic point, if I lost you at any point in what I just outlined, that the mainstream dominant concept of fascism is radically lacking in analytic rigor and in the power of conceptual generalization. The next section, which is very short, is fascism and imperialism. Here we arrive then at the heart of matters. The ideology of fascist exceptionalism seeks to render fascism a complete anomaly in the imperialist world order, thereby conceptually severing fascism from imperialism. The ideology of fascist overgeneralization aims at making fascism ubiquitous in the regions of the world that resist imperialism, the most significant of which are the countries that are building an anti-imperialist socialist world order. The bourgeois ideology of fascism thereby turns the world completely upside down, making fascism into a characteristic of anti-imperialist resistance rather than a fundamental feature of imperialism. This ideological inversion goes a long way to explaining how the dominant concept of fascism functions as a term of condemnation. The fascists are those to be morally condemned for resisting the global order of the so-called free world, meaning imperialism. They are, in short, our enemies. This bourgeois ideology of fascism was cemented into the bedrock of US-American ideology through the myth of the Good War. It is to this foundational ideological historical narrative that I'd now like to turn. So this is the title of the next section. So the United States emerged from the Second World War as the undisputed leader of the capitalist and imperialist camp. The former imperialist powers of Western Europe had been destroyed by the war. Its founding legend has been insightfully diagnosed by historian Jacques Powels in a book entitled The Myth of the Good War. There are a number of facets to this mythology, but the core belief is that the United States is an anti-fascist defender of democracy and freedom, whose mission is to support the so-called free world. It thereby arrived as a leader on the world stage under the banner of the defeat of fascism. Its culture industries, which are the most powerful in the world, have put all of their ample resources into spreading this message far and wide in an attempt to guarantee that the United States took the helm of global imperialism under the guise of being the greatest defender of democracy that the world has ever seen. The ideology of fascist exceptionalism within the imperialist world order was integral to the myth of the Good War. By cementing the idea that fascism is an anomaly within the imperialist world, and that it was defeated by the fearless guardian of democracy, it established a bedrock narrative, according to which the world order overseen by the United States was founded on the defeat of fascism and the victory of democracy. This is one of the reasons why there has been a very strong tendency within mainstream discourse to resist the use of the category of fascism when analyzing the imperialist order governed by the United States. It couldn't possibly be fascist because the United States became the leading world power through its world historical defeat of fascism. The ideology of fascist overgeneralization, which applies the category indiscriminate to communist countries as well as other nations that resist imperialism, has allowed the United States to further develop its founding narrative in terms of an ongoing fight against fascism. The Nazi designs of an evil empire were quickly followed by the Soviets and now the Chinese, according to the dominant narrative. The message is clear. If fascism exists in the world, it is to be located in the anti-imperialist movements, particularly those that pose the greatest threat because they have a universal and international project of anti-imperialist liberation. In this sense, the myth of the good war is the founding legend that consolidated both the ideology of fascist exceptionalism within the imperialist world and the ideology of its ubiquitous presence in the anti-imperialist world. Now, to be sure, the United States entered the war, World War II, on the side of the Soviets and contributed to the defeat of the Nazis. Some 400,000 US soldiers gave their lives fighting Nazism and fascism, making decisive contributions in Western Europe and Japan. If we were to use the vocabulary of Antonio Gramsci, we might say that there is a kernel of good sense, meaning a grain of truth, within the common sense narrative regarding the United States' anti-fascist orientation. However, this needs to be very seriously contextualized. The overwhelming majority of the Second World War was fought in the East, with some 27 million Soviets and 20 million Chinese giving their lives in the fight against fascism. They were the ones who deserve the greatest credit for defeating it, and many of them were self-declared communists. The United States entered the war very late and in an opportunist manner, with an eye to the spoils of war after it was clear that the Soviets were routing the Nazis. Moreover, it had not at all resisted the rise of fascism in spite of innumerable opportunities, such as during the Spanish Civil War, or when Stalin beseeched US-American leaders on numerous occasions to enter into an anti-fascist alliance. The US national security state also began cozying up to Nazi and fascist elements before the official end of hostilities. This is very well documented through internal documents that are available through Freedom of Information Act requests and in various archives that I've consulted. After the war, the United States established a veritable fascist international, integrating, and I know this might sound surprising to some of you, but it's extremely well documented. I have a number of articles on it with myriad references. Many of them archival, but there's also a lot of great historical scholarship. The United States integrated tens of thousands of fascists, these are from Italy and from Germany, into its ranks and many thousands more in a global empire. In doing so, the United States did not publicly declare itself to be the Fourth Reich. On the contrary, it has done everything in its power to maintain the narrative according to which it is the greatest defender of freedom and democracy. Its mobilization of fascist forces around the world has therefore been done under the cover of liberalism, as if it were spreading freedom and democracy. In order to break, then, with this dominant ideological concept of fascism and restore its theoretical use value, it's helpful to clarify the precise historical relationship between fascism and liberalism. The next section is entitled Liberalism and Fascism, Partners in Capitalist Crime. The dominant bourgeois concept of fascism presents it as the opposite of liberalism. And it also defines the very essence of the fight against fascism as the struggle for liberalism. Now, some of this makes sense insofar as liberal modes of governance tend to protect democratic rights for at least certain segments of the population. And I think particularly in a moment like the moment that we're in, the defense of liberal democratic rights is absolutely 100% necessary. That said, the idea that liberalism and fascism would be in fundamental opposition to one another misses something absolutely essential. And that is that fascism and liberalism are both forms of political management of capitalism. The oft-cited exemplary cases of Italy and Germany that I was talking about a moment ago are highly revealing in this regard. In Italy, in October of 1922, magnates in the Confederation of Industry, so some of the richest capitalists in Italy, provided Mussolini with millions in order to organize his march on Rome as a spectacular show of force. Fascism rises through the support of the capitalist ruling class. It is what you would call astroturf, right? Grassroots movements come organically from below. Astroturfing is a term for when you create the illusion that things come from below by parachuting finances from above. Fascism, as far as I know, at least all of the movements that I've studied are astroturfed movements. Italy is a great example of it. But what's interesting is Mussolini did not seize power. He had the capitalist class behind him. He'd done the march on Rome. He could have immediately declared a dictatorship. He didn't do that. Instead, he insisted on having elections and running a common slate in the elections with the liberals.
You're listening to Essential Dissent. This episode is a talk by Gabriel Rockhill called Liberalism and Fascism. Gabriel Rockhill is an American philosopher, writer, and cultural critic, and is professor of philosophy at Villanova University.
The fascists had only 35 seats in parliament, but thanks to the common slate with the liberals, they gained 286 seats in the parliament. This same basic pattern of ruling class financial backing and liberal complicity, right? We have to keep both of those things in mind. Ruling class backing and liberal complicity. This same pattern was visible in Germany. In a speech on October 19, 1935, Hitler reminisced on what it meant to have the material resources necessary to support 1,000 Nazi orators with their own cars who could hold some 100,000 public meetings in the course of a year. And this money was the industrialists in Germany, as well as actually U.S. foreign direct investment. Under the Nazis, rose extensively, and many U.S. capitalists invested very directly in Hitler. Ford is the most famous, but there are many, many others. Prior to the election, the Communist Party candidate Ernst Thälmann had argued that a vote for the conservative Field Marshal von Hindenburg amounted to a vote for Hitler and for war. Only weeks after Hindenburg's election, he invited Hitler to become chancellor. So Hitler became chancellor via an election and then an appointment. Fascism in both cases came to power through bourgeois parliamentary democracy, in which big capital bankrolled the candidates who would do its bidding while also creating a populist spectacle, false revolution, that marshaled or suggested mass appeal. Once its power was consolidated, it unflinchingly set about, and the rhythm was different, right? In Italy, it was very slow, the change. In Germany, they hit the gas pedal very quickly. But in both cases, they crushed organized labor, eradicated opposition parties, destroyed independent publications, put a halt to elections, scapegoated and eliminated racialized underclasses, privatized public assets, launched projects of colonial expansion, and invested heavily in a war economy beneficial to its industrial supporters. So capitalist states with bourgeois democracies at the time refused to form an anti-fascist coalition with the Soviet Union, a country that 14 of them had invaded and occupied from 1918 to 1920 in a failed attempt to destroy the world's first workers' republic. During the Spanish Civil War, Western liberal democracies did not officially support the left-leaning government that had been elected. Franco, of course, who was the fascist who was opposed to the left-wing government that had come to power through elections, is, according to his own words, a fascist. And he has a number of articles where he explains that he is himself a fascist. In 1934, the United Kingdom, France, and Italy signed the Munich Agreement, in which they agreed to allow Hitler to invade and colonize the Sudetenland in Czechoslovakia. Indeed, it was the fear of being left to confront Hitler alone that eventually drove Stalin, since 1934, the unswerving champion of an alliance with the West against Hitler, into the Stalin-Ribbentrop Pact of August 1939, by which he hoped to keep the USSR out of the war. This non-aggression pact was then disingenuously presented in the Western media as an undeniable indication that the Nazis and communists were somehow allies. There's been a study that was done that's quite interesting that showed that if that pact hadn't been signed, the non-aggression pact, it bought time for the Soviet Union to build up its productive forces and its war capacity. And if they hadn't done that, then there's a much stronger possibility that the Soviets would have lost the war against the Nazis. And if the Nazis had won against the Soviet Union, then we'd be speaking German in France now. I mean, it'd be a very, very different world. And that's the tip of the iceberg. The German Nazis killed, according to some statistics, 6 million people in gas chambers. They had plans to kill 60 million in the East. They were going to genocidally eliminate the socialist alternative of the Soviet Union. That was the plan. Hitler spelled it out, and Stalin knew it was coming, and he had to buy time in order to defend the people against fascist onslaught. So liberalism and fascism are best understood as capitalist modes of political management. The former rules primarily by consent, and the latter principally by repression. But they often work in tandem with one another. Liberalism, we might say, is the good cop of capitalism, and fascism is the bad cop. They both work together to ensure capitalist dominion. And this metaphor is important because, of course, if you have a choice between a good cop and a bad cop, it's much better to be working with somebody who's going to bring you coffee, let you make a phone call, try to cozy up to you, than somebody who's going to be getting a sledgehammer out and torturing you. So there should be no ultra-leftist perversion of the argument that I'm making. They work in tandem with one another to manage a capitalist society. But if we have to choose between the two, we have a much better chance working with the liberal good cop than the fascist bad cop. What I'm interested in sharing with you, and this is all ongoing research, is how then to draw on this kind of conceptual mapping of fascism to understand the current moment, and more specifically, the incoming Trump administration. So the Trump administration will not and has not changed the fundamental orientation of US foreign policy in any deep manner, and I'll get to some of the details. Having filled his administration with neoconservative war hawks, it is on course to intensify imperialist objectives in West Asia with the Greater Israel Project and the hybrid war on China, as well as progressive states and movements around the world. This imperialist tactic is slightly different than that of the Democrats. The Democrats had focused on the proxy war in the Ukraine against Russia, but the overall strategy of strengthening US-led imperialism is the same, right? The Democrats have been arguing for decades now that, well, we can fight Russia with China in the background more or less at the same time. The Republican and particularly the Trump orientation is China's the principal enemy. Let's try to cozy up to Russia, do a kind of Sino-Soviet split, and get Russia at least, you know, somewhat more on our side so that we can fight China principally. It's certainly the case that the Trump administration has worked to present itself as dedicated to global peace, when in fact it is above all devoted to pursuing imperialist hybrid wars while using some different tactics than the Democrats, in part to make it look like they're doing something fundamentally different. The war in the Ukraine was lost by NATO forces. And so when Trump comes in and presents it as if he's making some peace deal, we shouldn't be confused about what's going on. Russia won the war. They're never going to tell you that. They're never going to announce it. The US doesn't lose wars, even though they've been losing every war since Vietnam, with only a few exceptions. You know, Grenada in 1983, tiny island country. And many of the wars are very long and very drawn out, but the psychological warfare campaign is very clear: projection of power, never admit defeat. And so a lot of that narrative is just playing into the overall interests of US imperialism. Regarding domestic policy, the United States has historically maintained a bourgeois democracy for certain segments of the population. Of course, from its founding, the indigenous population, the African population, the propertyless population, and women all had inferior statuses of differing degrees, many of them lacking human and political rights, some of them having human rights, but no political rights, et cetera. There is a notorious study that I hope some of you have read from Princeton that demonstrated very clearly that the average citizen within the United States has little to no bearing on public policy. whereas major corporations through their lobbies have a major impact on public policy, basically demonstrating that if you define a democracy by people having power, U.S. people who can vote have no power, therefore you draw the conclusion. I don't think you have to take a sophisticated logic class to arrive at the appropriate conclusion that it's an oligarchic plutocracy, not a democracy. There is also a very powerful police state that makes constant war on the most oppressed and exploited members of the working class, particularly the immigrant population and racialized groups. Victims of this police state, like George Jackson, have described it as fascist in its repression of the working class, and the U.S. has established the largest prison and detention system in the world, not to mention a global system of carceral black sites. So in spite of some tactical disagreements, both the Democrats and the Republicans partake in what I would describe as imperial fascism, meaning the use of fascist death squads, dictatorships, and militias around the world. It's a very well-documented history. Just to cite one example, William Bloom, a former member of the State Department who then turned against the State Department, has documented in great detail that there's only one country in the world that has endeavored to overthrow some 50 foreign governments since World War II, the majority of which were democratically elected. And so in that regard, there's a great quote by Victor Marchetti, who had served in the CIA for about 12 years, I think, maybe 15. And he said, "We support every half dictator, military junta, and death squad around the world. And we do it because it serves our interests, principally our business interests." The other aspect of fascism that both the Democrats and the Republicans agree on is police state fascism, the use of violent state forces to indiscriminately strip people of their human and political rights is integral, unfortunately, to the history of the United States. And of course, we're seeing an uptick in that violence most recently. So if we engage in a refined analysis of the contemporary United States, we also have to recognize that there is still a liberal bourgeois order. Liberal democracy tends to manage the professional managerial class stratum and the upper layers of the working class, as well as acquiescent members of the domestic population. Fascism, though, is unleashed on the non-acquiescent workers of the global South, as well as the racialized and potentially insurgent underclass on the home front. Rather than complete opposites, these modes of governance function as the good cop, liberalism, and the bad cop, fascism, of capitalism. What a dialectical analysis, and dialectical is just in this sense, meaning that you look at how these forms of governance are interrelated and interact with one another. What this dialectical mode of analysis demonstrates is that just like the notorious interrogation tactic, the good cop and bad cop, as much as they would like us to believe that they have opposite agendas, right? This is the whole political theater we're constantly subjected to. Democrats hate the Republicans and the Republicans hate the Democrats and this is all that we have to focus on. Without the recognition that actually, as Obama said publicly when Trump was first elected, he said, we all play on the same team. That's team capital. In this regard, Trump has been very explicit about intensifying the war on the most oppressed and exploited members of the working class. And this is the material objective behind his racism and misogyny, right? The racism and misogyny are very thin cover for a war on the most oppressed and the most exploited members of the working class, who have always been the racialized groups and women, always under capitalism. I should qualify that. He seeks to escalate this war on the working class by targeting its lowest tiers. And if you're able to drive down the lowest tiers, you bring wages down for all workers. So it's a war on the entire working class. And we should never think that the war against the most exploited and oppressed members of the working class is somehow good for other members of the working class. It's driving their wages down to force us to work for lower wages. That's the whole gambit. And then the goal is to have us get on board with that project by waging the war against the most oppressed and exploited workers, instead of recognizing that we have common cause with them, because we're all members of the working class, and the ruling class is trying to divide us to better conquer us. This is all packaged by Trump in an ultra-nationalist religiously inflected ideology of scapegoating, a tactic taken directly out of the playbook of so many fascist demagogues. In a phase of imperialist decline, which is the overriding framework of what's going on, the US empire is in decline. The golden age of US empire building was in the 50s, 60s, the kind of golden age of capitalism. It's well behind us. And the leaders of this country know that full well, and so does the ruling class. It's materially obvious to most people that the United States is not economically as well off as it once was. And the idea of making America great again plugs neatly into a logic of nationalist and religious rejuvenation via racist scapegoating, if it be against the racialized working class, the immigrants in particular, or against the Chinese as the representatives of a systemic alternative to imperialism. This project has emboldened and empowered fascist organizations in the United States, like the Proud Boys, the Oath Keepers, and the Three Percenters. It has also been dedicated to dismantling democratic rights, this is the Trump administration, and increasingly making the bourgeois legal state into a gangster capitalist state run by robber barons. Indeed, Trump already worked with reactionary elements of the state and fascist militias, while backed, as always, by the most reactionary elements of the capitalist ruling class and finance capital in particular, to try and overturn the last election. He's also on record repeating that 2024 was the last election. What a dialectical analysis of fascism reveals is that it is a process of socio-political management that comes in different degrees. And our analysis needs to be fine-grained enough that it is attentive to all of the dimensions of governance. It is true that there is not, at this point, an open fascist dictatorship in the United States. And that's a very good thing. I think we can all agree. Anyone who's serious about practical politics should defend liberal rights and democratic rule over their fascist annihilation. The reason for criticizing liberal democracy, as Domenico Lissordo and others have trenchantly argued, is not to abolish it, but rather to transform its false universalism, right? Liberalism says we're all free and equal, but we find out that we're actually not. We want to translate that false universalism into a true universalism. That is the goal. It's also the case that the ideological bedrock of the United States is that it's an anti-fascist democratic country intent on spreading freedom and democracy. Although this is patently untrue in many ways, there's nonetheless a powerful historical narrative and institutions that have been established along these lines. Changing this takes time. The current administration is arresting, detaining, and deporting immigrants and activists without respecting due process and basic democratic rights. It's obviously testing the waters to see how far it can get. And there is every reason to think that these activities will expand. However, it is not, or has not, disappeared some 30,000 people as the Argentine dictatorship, backed by the Central Intelligence Agency and the United States, did in Latin America. It's not running mass extermination camps like the Nazis did, right? So we have to be able to see that fascism as a process is not an all or nothing phenomenon. In French, they talk about fascisation. So it's a process of, it sounds awkward in English, fascisation, you know, the becoming fascist. That's what's going on. Although Trump attempted to undermine the last election, he didn't succeed. And he has not, at least yet, been able to completely transform the bourgeois state into an open dictatorship. Fascism needs to be understood as a process with different degrees of intensification. The version we are currently exposed to is a lower grade than the examples of Argentina and the Nazis that I just cited, but it nonetheless shares the same fundamental orientation: anti-communist, pro-imperialist, and reactionary. What the Trump administration represents, then, is an ongoing intensification of imperial and police state fascism, combined with an open war on democratic rights, a rolling back of the bourgeois rule of law, and an effort to embolden parastate fascist forces, right? 1,600 people convicted of seditious conspiracy were let out of prison by Trump. The degree of fascistization, sorry for the awkward formulation, will depend on class struggle, as well as on the overall economic and geopolitical situation. The US's imperial decline and the rise of China as the shepherd of a multipolar world is the overall context within which the capitalist ruling class invested in Trump in order to try and rejuvenate their super profits and halt China. That's the goal. It is unlikely, for many reasons, that he will succeed in this task, though he will certainly engage in more drastic measures. This lack of success will lead, however, as it already has, to an intensification of the class war on workers in the United States. When colonialism meets limits abroad, it brings it to the home front. That, I think, is a very well-established historical front. When US-led imperialism cannot get super profits by subjugating workers in the colonial periphery, it brings that war on workers much more intensely to the home front. As its imperial dominion declines, the repressive tactics used around the world will increasingly be used on its own population to maintain capitalist super profits by any means necessary. When imperialism doesn't succeed abroad, right, this is what I just said, then violent tactics are brought to bear on its local population. We already see in this war on the most exploited and oppressed members of the working class, the immigrant population. The point of this war is not to eliminate the immigrant working class, but rather to make their conditions so difficult that they're willing to work for less. The US economy depends on immigrant labor. They don't want to get rid of all. They'll never say that publicly, but the economy depends on them. But they want to drive wages down for all workers, and they also are waging a war on consumers. The tariffs are that. Who pays for the tariffs? We pay for the tariffs. It's a war on consumers. So every time you hear the percentages, think, well, next time I go and buy X, Y, or Z, I'm going to be paying more. And where's that money go? To a gangster capitalist state captured by the most reactionary elements of the financial ruling class who want to squeeze us that much more. One unique feature of the United States is that the organized anti-capitalist left has been decimated from years of war. The so-called left has been effectively redefined as a pro-capitalist and pro-imperialist left. Although there's a fringe moment of parties and organizations representing a socialist alternative to the capitalist mainstream, these have much less power and weight than in most capitalist countries, including others in the imperial core. The very culture of leftism has been largely, although not completely, destroyed in the United States. This is one of the important organizing tasks in the leading imperialist country. We need to develop institutions, organizations, networks, media, and educational platforms necessary to sustain the development of a real anti-capitalist culture. Another characteristic of the United States is that its working class, as part of the labor aristocracy, meaning a working class that is at the very top of international pyramids of labor, has been notoriously conservative and anti-communist. Both its position in global value chains, so the fact that it's at the top of the pyramid, and its indoctrination by imperial culture industries have made it loath to oppose imperialism and support the socialist struggle against it. Rather than a revolutionary or proto-revolutionary working class, the US government is facing a working class that has been largely domesticated, particularly when compared to the high points of labor struggles in the history of the United States or internationally. Nevertheless, there's a very insurgent labor movement that is arguably gaining strength, and the current state of the world is radicalizing an increasing number of people. The way I see the current state of the world is that the contradictions of global class struggle between the imperialist forces and the anti-imperialist forces are sharpening. And the war on the domestic working class is intensifying. So it's very likely that more people are going to come to question the viability of the system they live in. We're also facing a world where capitalist-driven climate change is eliminating the conditions of possibility of human existence. It's code red for humanity. According to the United Nations, there could be no more Homo sapiens in 50 years. So the state of class struggle, the state for the struggle of the nature of the world that we want, has never been higher. It's an existential struggle for life. What that means is a lot more people are going to get radicalized because they're going to recognize that former generations didn't do the hard work necessary to move the world in the direction that we need. This is one of the reasons why the war on journalism and education is so central to the current administration. As class struggle intensifies on the home front, due to the violence of imperialism in decline, as well as the patent fact that the capitalist-driven destruction of the biosphere is rendering life impossible, or will soon, more people are going to be pushed into questioning the dominant system. Misdirecting their frustrations will be absolutely central to the maintenance of the system. They have to destroy education. They have to destroy journalism. They can't deal with an informed public that's getting radicalized due to the state of the world. They need the stultification of the US public because it's a bedrock element of the way they rule. William Casey, head of the Central Intelligence Agency under Ronald Reagan, when asked to describe the role of his agency, the CIA, said the following: "We will know our disinformation program is complete when everything the American public believes is false." That's the agenda. The longstanding project of rendering the US American population ignorant is also a very important factor in analyzing the state of contemporary fascism. Given, unfortunately, how uneducated the general public is, which is due to no fault of its own, but because of the disinformation industries operative in schools and the media and the war on education and journalism, as well as the overworking of the population, right? People working three jobs don't have as much time to educate themselves or be educated. So we're dealing with a situation in which the general public isn't as informed as it could otherwise be, and such a population is much more malleable to ruling class agendas. I guess maybe I'll just say one final thing in conclusion, and that is that although this talk hasn't been as gay and happy as hopefully my opening comments were about how happy I am to be back in Kansas, there is something that is really important and worthy of excitement. And that is that if you think in a distinction between subjective experience, like my experience as an individual, we are living in a world where if you're not a member of the ruling class, and I assume that most people here are not, meaning, you know, I think it's 4 or 5 US Americans who own the equivalent of what 50% of the entire population owns, right? These are people who are super rich, and that wealth comes from the immiseration of everyone else. It doesn't fall out of the sky. If you're not one of those people, then subjectively and individually, most likely your lives, like my life, are going to get a lot worse. That's the negative. The positive is, if you look at global history, what we're living through is the decline of the US empire. The US is not as powerful economically, militarily, culturally, etc., as it once was. This creates an incredible, incredible opportunity. An opportunity to break the imperial stranglehold that the United States has operated around the world in order to not just liberate ourselves, but also those in the global South who have been under the jackboot of US imperialism. And so sometimes you have to make subjective sacrifices for the overall gain of humanity and the objective course, hopefully, of history, which will depend on us and what we do. But we can contribute to a world in which people are given power instead of the reactionary ruling class that is trying to divide, conquer, and ultimately destroy all of us and the planet in due course.
You've been listening to Essential Dissent. This episode was a talk by Gabriel Rockhill called Liberalism and Fascism. Gabriel Rockhill is an American philosopher, writer, and cultural critic, and is professor of philosophy at Villanova University. The event was sponsored by the Young Democratic Socialists of America and took place on April 18, 2025 at Kansas State University. Please note that the views expressed on Essential Dissent are those of the individual speakers and do not necessarily represent my own views or those of this radio station. We'll end with a short piece written by Caitlin Johnstone and read by Tim Foley. I'm Wilton Vaught, saying thanks for listening, and remember, never believe anything until you hear the official denial.
A truth-based relationship with reality requires courage. Ultimately, it comes down to courage. Being brave enough to stare squarely at the horrors of Gaza, to face the harsh reality that we are ruled by monsters and our civilization is diseased, to bring our own inner darkness into the light of consciousness where it can be healed. Coming into a truth-based relationship with reality requires courage. That's all I'm ever really talking about in this space when all is said and done. coming into a truth-based relationship with reality, both collectively as a society and as individuals. Because that's the only thing that can ever lead to health and harmony. The human species will never move into a healthy relationship with each other and with Earth's ecosystem as long as our behavior is driven by power-serving systems justified by indoctrinated lies and propaganda. The human individual will never know inner peace if it remains driven by unconscious inner forces and unhealed trauma. These unwholesome dynamics are not going to correct themselves. Untruth needs to be directly confronted, both in the empire under which we live and inside ourselves. This takes courage. It is uncomfortable to look directly at the horrors the Western Empire is unleashing in Gaza and elsewhere. It can be scary to confront the possibility that everything you've been taught about your world and your country is a lie. It can be extremely frightening to look deep within yourself with the intention of uncovering all the unpleasant truths you have hidden from yourself over the years. It can be downright terrifying to seek spiritual enlightenment, only to discover that it entails losing yourself and your entire world. Lies are comforting. Truth is scary. But truth is the only way out of the dysfunction we have created for ourselves. So if we want peace, health, and happiness, we're going to have to get brave. We must look precisely where we don't want to look. We must welcome the revelations we least hope to see. We must make friends with the ugliest of truths. We must get comfortable with discomfort. That's the only way out of this mess. The transition into a healthy and harmonious world will be a great leap into the complete unknown, because it will be a shift into something that has never existed on this planet before. That leap will not be made until we are ready to make it, come what may. Until then, we can only act in courageous service of truth in what little ways we are able. Learn as much as we can about our world and our society, especially the parts we'd rather avoid. Speak the truth about what we are seeing, especially when our voice shakes. Bring our unconscious wounds and delusions into consciousness and enlighten that which is darkened, especially in the ways we are most reluctant to. Humanity can only walk into the light of truth one trembling step at a time, and we are each responsible for our own steps on that journey.